4P97, welcome to week three. This week we'll focus on hockey demographics. We're going to have a guest lecture. We're going to be talking about the media analysis. I'll be getting at that right away. First, I want to fill you in on a tournament that we study and a tournament that we actually attended. The 2023 National Aboriginal Hockey Championships in beautiful Winnipeg, Manitoba at the Seven Oaks Sportsplex. We had a team of researchers there that is researching this exact topic, and that is hockey demographics. We had a great time. That tournament is spectacular. I'm going to be talking to you a lot about that tournament this semester, off and on. This tournament features the best Indigenous U18 players from across the country. There were players there that are going Div 1 NCAA. There are players there that are going into the WHL, the OHL, the Q. They're going scholarships down south, U Sports on the female and male side. A really fantastic tournament. Team Manitoba, the team that we were actually helping do analytics for, and we were also helping with a little bit of scouting, a little bit of in-game adjustments. They won gold on the men's side and silver on the female side. Super proud of that team. Super proud of every team. And Team Ontario won gold on the female side and silver on the men's side. So a lot of fun in Winnipeg there. It really was a really fantastic arena. If you've never been to Winnipeg before, maybe you're from Winnipeg, maybe you know the Seven Oaks Sportsplex, so maybe I'm telling you about something you already know. Anyways, we're going to start things off today by talking about your media analysis. That is the most pressing issue facing you right now. The media analysis asks you to be analyzing a piece of hockey media. The assignment involves answering key questions based on a specific podcast, news report, panel discussion, etc., to determine the relationship between the chosen medium and the speaker's message. In full paragraphs with APA citations, find a minimum of 3 secondary sources that address key topics in your choice of media. Now, here you're going to see a collection of 5 questions. Perhaps you've been in a course with me before, perhaps not, that's okay. This is a common refrain in my courses, which is to say, here's your points I'd like you to address, please. Certainly now, by heading into fourth year, I think we can raise the bar a little bit here. I don't want a list of answers to those 5 questions. I don't want question 1, your answer. Question 2, your answer. Question 3, your answer. You're going to be answering these questions over the course of complete paragraphs. Okay, so I'm sorry if I've repeated these same instructions to you before, but I need to repeat them here. These are the questions that I want you to consider. Just consider, not just provide point form answers to. What points of view are being included? Who, if anyone, has vested interests being served through this account? What prior experiences and or skills have influenced the writer's or speaker's point of view? What media format has been selected by the creators? Is this format effective at conveying the message? And what secondary literature addresses topics covered in this media selection? How does this media treatment of this topic fit within the context of secondary literature on this very topic? Those are the questions I'm looking for you to incorporate. I've provided a list of media examples to you as well on Brightspace, so you can head there if you need any help selecting sources. You don't need to choose those sources. You are free to choose your own source, but if you need help finding some, those are the articles that I provided there to you, as well as a list of sources on the media analysis outline, which is also provided on Brightspace, that you can go and find on your own. If there is actually going to be a hot link on the source itself, if you can access it online. If you can't, if it's just in black, it'll be in the media examples folder. On the course outline, you are going to see 2 due dates on the course outline. If you have a look at the course outline on Brightspace, you'll see them. There's going to be 2 due dates. If you've been in a course with me before, you know how this all works. But if you have not, just as a quick reminder, how this works is this. That first due date that you see on the course outline, that is for written feedback once you've received your grade, okay? So essentially what this does is it gives our TAs the opportunity to just have a little bit of extra time to write out your feedback. And if you need the extra couple days and you just want the number grade, that's fine too. Because at any time throughout the entire semester, you can always come and see me for feedback. That's never a problem. But we just have these little bit of extra wiggle room for our TAs to be able to provide you with the written feedback itself. It takes a little while to do that, but sometimes near the due date, sometimes some students end up taking a little bit of an extension. So that's how it works. There are 2 due dates, but it's only one submission total, submitted via Brightspace in the submission folder. So what am I asking you to do here? The outline is fairly clear. This is a fairly simple assignment, but what I really want you to do is dig in here. I want you to try and change the way that you view hockey. We've been talking about demographics. You've had a guest lecturer already. You're going to have a few guest lecturers come in. What I do not want is you simply listening to a podcast and summarizing that podcast. Please don't do that. I don't need a summary of a Spittin' Chiclets episode. I don't need a summary of a 32 Thoughts episode. I don't need a summary of an athletic podcast. I can just go simply listen to that podcast if I'd like a summary, right? I'm looking for you to dig in. When I'm asking you about vested interests, sometimes I've had that question come up frequently. What is a vested interest? What that essentially means here is whose interests are served financially. Is someone trying to sell you something? Is someone trying to change the way you buy things or consume things or the way that you experience the game of hockey or sports in any way? So think critically here, not just simply listing off the advertisers. That's not good enough. If you simply provide a summary of your piece of media, you will receive a suitably average to below average grade, and you're not going to be pleased with that. Okay? So dig in, really take these questions seriously, really consider sources that you've listened to. If you listen to these sources on the regular or you read these sources on the regular, that's totally fine. If you've never read a piece of hockey media for fun or interest on your own before, this is a perfect time to start to really take your lens and sharpen it in on the media, the way that hockey is reported in the media. Why are we doing this? We're doing this because it's important as critical consumers of the game of hockey to make sure that when we consume hockey content, our critical brains are activated, right? We want to be able to say, what is going on here? Is this something that is indicative of a broader issue? That's why when you're choosing a piece of media, it is crucial that you choose something that is a little substantial. Not a story about the trade deadline, not necessarily a story about lines that are being updated or a player being called up from the American League, because that's a separate part of the sort of media discussion, which we'll have a little bit later with Tori Peterson, who manages the social media accounts of an NHL team. That's a different part of the job. This is the sort of more substantial issues facing the game itself and the more substantial task of digesting media and hockey specifically. So I encourage you here now, again, dig into this one and really take these questions seriously and not just simply at face value. And certainly do not just provide me a list of answers to these questions in essentially a bullet form. Okay? That's the sort of media analysis talk we're going to be getting into our discussion of hockey demographics. All right, let's talk demographics. So this is an issue that is extremely important for the way in which we understand hockey today. It's something that's at the front of mind for companies involving involved in the hockey space. It's certainly front of mind for Hockey Canada. It's front of mind for NHL organizations. Where do elite players come from? Where do hockey players in general come from? And how have these things changed? And as we're going to look at the article, do we have preconceived notions about where to find these players? And are these preconceived notions perhaps inhibiting our ability to find them? Later on, when we talk to Byron Bader, who runs a draft website and has developed a data analysis tool to evaluate hockey prospects, we're going to be talking about some of these issues as they relate to the NHL draft. But we're going to be talking today about the same process, but from a more grassroots level here, which is to say, how do you incorporate these things into the way that we understand the industry as a whole? Well, we got to go back in time first. We got to figure out what the traditional background of a hockey player is. We've talked about before that the institutional home of hockey in the 19th century was Montreal. 1875, you have their very first game. We've talked about this briefly. Now, I've got some information on the slides there that detail sort of the historical nature of hockey's progression here. We've also kind of already talked about this in previous lectures, so I don't want to dwell on it for too long here. It's this notion of middle class, though, that I want to focus on, because it's extremely important for the way that we understand how hockey players are located within Canadian contexts, how hockey players are identified today, and how hockey players of tomorrow may look different. Colin Howell argues, quote, because hockey drew most of its players from the middle class, young businessmen, professionals, university students, and so on, and because it had secured the support of so many important members of the social hierarchy, the game was never seriously threatened by its critics. This is in the early 20th century, the late 19th century. Howell is one of the foremost hockey historians alive right now, and he's saying basically, look, the game itself has middle class origins, and these origins are what enabled the game to grow so quickly across Canada. This is basically beyond debate at this point. If you have done any reading on this subject or research into this, the hockey's relationship to the middle class is inextricable. Hockey in Central Canada was almost exclusively involved young middle-class males beginning in the mid-19th century, though we have plenty of evidence of women playing hockey dating far back as the 19th century as well. But this middle-class influence on hockey is directly related to the exceptionally important influence that amateurism had on the development of organized sport in Central Canada. We've talked about this briefly in previous lectures. Essentially, in its earliest years, the working class was largely excluded from organized hockey in Canada. Now again, it's important that we take some time here and identify what we mean by working class, what we mean by middle class. Too often these terms are used interchangeably. They are very different. The working class, especially when we talk about this in the early 20th century, late 19th century, we mean those who are working just to survive. We are meaning those on the sort of very, very margin of comfort in society, those that have to work for a living. The middle class, on the other hand, is the entrepreneurial class, doctor, teacher, lawyer, that kind of thing. Okay? So don't confuse those things. I know by your fourth year in university, you should probably know the difference between those two terms, but perhaps you've never come across it or never had to put a fine point on it. There you go. That's the difference. Hockey is this middle class game for the sons, largely sons, Anglo-speaking sons of the entrepreneurial class in Central Canada during these early, early years. Now, this changes to some extent, but the extent to which it has changed is something that I do want you to think about very carefully as we move throughout this course. When I offer these descriptions of the game's past, this is something that is dear to me, this period in hockey history. It's something that you can do your own research in if you prefer. But you can have a look at this period in the game's history, and I want you to observe this and think to yourself, has the game changed? Has it moved? Has it expanded very far? What is our idea of what a hockey player is and where they come from? This is something that I think we should take some time to consider as well.
I grew up in the small town, a hockey night in my hometown kind of place. There was really not much around. You blink and you miss it. I never knew what life would bring, but I always had big dreams. Early mornings down at the rink, and every night I'd wish that I'd get a shot at the big game. Here on the claim, say my name. So I played hard and dreamed about the day I'd lift the Stanley Cup up high. Cause that's where I come from, that's who I am. Hard working and God bless. Yes, sir, thank you, man. The best things around that I have ever seen.
This was a purposeful interlude. I wanted you to have a listen to the lyrics of that song. I'm not a huge country music guy, but perhaps you already know this song. Perhaps you know the artist itself. I wanted you to hear that song. That's Paul Brandt, a song called Small Towns and Big Dreams. That is the hometown hockey version, which features Tara Sloan. Also singing, you can have a look at that on YouTube. It's if you're there, if you'd like to listen to it. But this is where we're at right now with a lot of what we imagine to be the makeup of a hockey player. So you listen to those lyrics again. If you can even look at that song if you want to listen to it in more detail. But this ended up being a song that was used for the 2018 Hockey Day in Canada. And you can again see the full version of it. It comes with a visual component as well, showing images of small town hockey players. And this is something that I think is really crucial to the place that hockey resides in the Canadian cultural imagination. I think there is a conception that hockey is related to small town life, that there is a rural connection to hockey, that playing outdoors in small towns is maybe an authentic version of the game. This is something that hockey's constantly at war with. What is the authentic version of the game? Who has an authentic claim to the game? Whose version of hockey is real and which one is artificial? Does this mean that if you grew up in a city that you have no possible way of relating to the lyrics that Paul Brandt is singing there? Now, while it's fair to say, okay, well, look, this is just a country song. Who cares about its larger cultural implications for the game of hockey? I think it's important because it's the way in which the game is marketed, not just by Sportsnet when they choose to do Hockey Day in Canada the way that they do, or when they do hometown hockey once a week, and they've altered that broadcast schedule, but it's still a very valuable cultural product to the game. Certainly, Ron McLean still carries a lot of value, and he is very very much about maintaining a sense of the game's history or a version of the game's history that he's extremely interested in, and Rogers has been able to capitalize in. So it's important that we understand what this looks like. But it is very unusual if you consider the origins of the game and if you consider the ways in which the game has been producing hockey players in general, but certainly at the highest levels. Now, your reading this week is, I think, is just fascinating. The article that I want you to read addresses this, with this connection to the rural roots of the game, the small town hockey connection that many of us feel, I think, is a large part of Canada's connection to the game itself, and this city game, this version of the city game that has been able to produce elite hockey players so frequently. Now, I've often said it's just absolutely remarkable. You could drive coast to coast, and I've done this, cross Canada drive a couple times, and every single time you stop for gas, there is a town that has an NHLer in it. And it is remarkable. It's absolutely remarkable. And it gives the impression that every single small town produces NHLers, and therefore the NHL must be comprised mostly of players from small towns. But have a look at your reading. Have a look at the research done about where NHLers are coming from. So now we know the origins of the game, where this middle-class game from urban Montreal, from the most densely populated part of Montreal during this period as well. And understand that there might be a disconnect between the way in which hockey players are perceived in the Canadian imagination and where it is that they're actually coming from. Now, whether or not this is an issue for the way that hockey is producing elite players is something that is certainly on the minds of Hockey Canada. Is hockey becoming a game that only the wealthy can play? Or, should we say this more accurately, is hockey becoming a game where the elite of the elite of the elite can only come from wealthy areas? Now, again, there are statistically significant samples where that's not true. And there are anecdotal examples of players that don't come from this background in the modern NHL, and I'm sure you can think of a few of them off the top of your head, and that's fantastic. But we're talking about overall demographic changes today. We're talking about the overall demographics. So one or two examples that you can name off of the top of your head is not terribly helpful when we're talking about large demographic shifts. So why don't you have that in mind when we're talking about demographics and also when you're doing this reading. But the conclusion reached by the authors is fascinating, and I think that the first part of that genuinely surprised me, their sort of initial finding about the game's maybe more recent history from, say, the 1980s and 1990s and early 2000s. It surprised me, but I want you to have a look and read for yourself what they found out. Why is this important, right? Why we're talking about this with relation to your writing now, with your critical analysis projects that you're going to be doing a little bit later on. This is a big issue. And this is an issue that's related to many different topics that we're going to be covering in class. It's going to be related to a lot of topics that you're going to be presenting on a little bit later on in this semester. And that's this notion of who is playing the game and how can it grow? How can we address new populations, right? And we can't really plan these things. We talk a lot, an endless amount in hockey circles about growing the game. Game's got to grow, got to market it better, got to market our stars. Over and over and over again, we hear all these solutions about how we got to do things differently, but very few times do we stop and actually consider the way the game exists right now. And there's a lot of sort of maybe pseudo-research that's done into this field that sort of feels like we understand what the game looks like, but we need to understand specifically what the game is like right now. If you seek to overhaul this industry or offer new insights, you're going to need a keen understanding of what it looks like right now. So we kind of have two issues that we're dealing with right here. The larger sociocultural issues, the experiential issues that we talked about, where, you know, what's the experience of experiencing the hockey industry itself. But we also have these larger statistical demographic shifts that we have to talk about as well. So especially if you're seeking to work in the business side of things in the hockey world, or if it's something you haven't thought about but you'd like to get into. We have to understand the way in which the hockey industry exists as an industry right now. So these demographic shifts tell us a very interesting thing about where hockey players are coming from. Now, when you read the article and you read the conclusions reached, I want you to ask yourself some questions about this. Does the NHL consider this a problem? And when we say, and again, I've said this already in a previous lecture, but I want to reintroduce it. When I say hockey, I don't mean the NHL. When I say hockey, I don't mean Hockey Canada. But there are some issues that I think the NHL and Hockey Canada would be, I think, jointly interested in and maybe jointly concerned about. If the conclusions of the article are reasons for concern for either of those two parties, how would you suggest going about this and fixing it? These are questions I want you to ask yourself when you're doing these readings. I suspect we'll be addressing this in your form and audio response in some fashion in the second audio lecture, but I want you to just keep this in your mind as you're doing these readings. What can be done to address this? Right? When you're doing your critical analysis project at the end of semester, when you're doing your presentations, keep these things in mind. Right? are these demographic changes problematic? Or is this a recognition of a phenomenon that's been occurring for decades and simply this is just the modern feature of sport as a whole? So we'll finish off our discussion of what the demographic shifts have been over time in our next lecture, but I want you to again to begin this discussion of demographics by noting again the history of the game itself. This middle-class, white Anglo-Saxon game born in the cities, specifically born in Montreal for the most part, and then expanded throughout central Canada and further, I want you to remember that sort of middle-class origin. How does that compare to our modern assertion that the game has a connection to small towns, rural Canada, the version of hockey that is sold to us from the Heritage Classic, Hockey Day in Canada, Hockey Night in Canada, Hockey Day in Canada, any of these various properties? There's a lot of money to be made in tapping into this feeling. So what is it about hockey that makes us yearn for that sort of rural connection? Now, you yourself might even be from one of these small towns. And there, I am not here to dispute the connection between small towns and hockey. It is 100% verifiably true across Canada. But why is this such a large fixation for many of the larger cities in Canada? Why is this notion of a rural game more authentic to many Canadians than the versions of the city game? Because I want you to ask yourself a question about an origin story for many hockey players. And I think about this when you're watching maybe you've seen the Amazon special on the Toronto Maple Leafs. Maybe you've seen 24/7, the special HBO when they follow around a team. Maybe you've seen any of these hockey documentaries, even some of the PR done by the various teams themselves. When they go into the backstory of the players, when they present how they introduce themselves to the game, there are certain things that these media institutions and these companies and the people that, you know, present these stories look for. They look for certain talismans, certain ways in which they think audiences will latch onto. And there are certain things that are omitted. There are certain aspects of their stories that maybe don't get told. I think to where the way in which Austin Matthews was presented in his very first moments of the Amazon documentary, and there's an interesting way in which Matthews was presented. If you've seen it, that's fantastic. If you haven't, Matthews' journey is described as unorthodox, which it, of course, it is if you're familiar with his journey, but this connection to a sort of small-town version of hockey, or a rural version of the game itself, just a different version of what rural means in his context, is definitely highlighted. But there's a lot omitted about how that journey really went. There is this need to sort of paint everyone as somewhat similar in terms of their interpretation of the game, and that similarity is normally a connection to what we're talking about today with this notion of small towns. So why is that? Right? If you grew up in an apartment complex with no access to an outdoor rink and you made it to the NHL, is your story is your hockey origin story less authentic? Is your claim to the game less Canadian? Right? If you grew up in a suburb with strip malls and community center arenas with four pads and you made the NHL that way, is that less authentic than the person that grew up in a small town in Saskatchewan? These are interesting questions, and there's a larger point that we're going to make at the end of the semester here and towards the end of the semester, and certainly even we're going to pick up next week. But I want us to start by asking these important questions about demographics, which is just fundamentally the question of where do NHLers, where do hockey players come from, who gets to play? You can see, I think, where we're going with some of these topics and some of the issues that are facing the modern-day NHL, but I want us to start with these very, very, very fundamental questions, and I want you to hear a piece of that article, which is posted on Brightspace right here.
It is such a contrasting image of community and hockey in Canada, the long-lasting notion of the small-town advantage or the big-city reality of a high-cost sport that motivates our study. We will illustrate and contextualize the changing relationship between community and participation in elite-level hockey in Canada over the past four decades. We aim to put the birthplace effect research into broad social context. We argue that the birthplace effect research focuses on the optimal community size from a sports science point of view, but does not address the changing hometown geography of elite Canadian hockey players. Our research questions are twofold. First, how has the geographic distribution of Canadian-raised NHL players changed since 1970 in terms of province, community size, and distance to large cities? Second, how has the association between hometown community size and participation in elite hockey changed over time? To answer these questions, we examine the geographic distribution of the hometown of Canadian-raised NHL players from 1970 to 2015 using publicly available information on NHL players.
That's it for part one of week three of 4P97. Just a quick reminder again about office hours on Fridays. The link to joining office hours has been posted on Brightspace as well. If you've got questions about your media analysis, pass them along. Make sure that you have a look at the list of media analysis sources that have been provided, and make sure you have a look at the assignment outline. All of that has been posted on Brightspace. Keep up with your form and your audio responses. Another one will be released on Wednesday. And I'm looking forward to talking with you and listening to your audio responses.